What happens when a renowned psychotherapist discovers he has terminal cancer? For Julius Hertzfeld, this devastating diagnosis becomes a profound wake-up call. At 65, with less than a year to live, Julius embarks on a journey to evaluate his life's work and legacy. His quest leads him to Philip Slate, a former patient he considers his greatest failure. After 3 years of unsuccessful therapy for sexual addiction, Philip disappeared, only to resurface years later as a philosophical counselor devoted to the teachings of Arthur Schopenhauer, the pessimistic 19th-century philosopher. Their unexpected reunion sets in motion a complex relationship that challenges both men's fundamental beliefs about healing, human connection, and the meaning of life itself. As Julius confronts his mortality, he invites Philip to join his therapy group, creating a crucible where philosophy meets psychology and where each character must face their deepest fears and desires. Julius receives the news on an ordinary Tuesday afternoon. Malignant melanoma with less than a 25% 5-year survival rate. The diagnosis divides his life into before and after, plunging him into profound existential turmoil for a week. In the medical library, Julius obsessively studies oncology journals, visualizing cancer cells colonizing his body. Though previously skeptical of spirituality, he develops personal rituals, marking each sunrise with quiet reflection. A breakthrough occurs during his therapist support group when an unexpected 20-minute silence creates a profound connection among colleagues that feels almost sacred. Finding wisdom in Nietzsche's call to consummate your life, Julius resolves to continue his therapeutic work rather than waste time grieving. But first, he must confront his greatest professional failure. This compels Julius to reconnect with Philip Slate, beginning a journey that will challenge everything he thought he knew about healing and connection. Arthur Schopenhauer's childhood was devoid of affection. His father Heinrich was stern and unyielding, while his mother Johanna, who married Heinrich at 17 in an arranged match, was vivacious but unhappy. Arthur's only genuine happiness came during 2 years in Le Havre at age 9, living with his father's business partner. Returning to his family afterward proved especially painful. When Arthur was 16, Heinrich committed suicide. Despite his father's harshness, Arthur remained devoted to him. Meanwhile, Johanna reinvented herself, selling the family business, moving to Weimar, establishing a popular salon, and befriending Goethe. She became Germany's first professional female writer, achieving such fame that Arthur was initially known merely as Johanna Schopenhauer's son. This love-deprived childhood shaped Arthur's misanthropic philosophy. His masterpiece, The World as Will and Representation, presents existence as driven by relentless will, creating cycles of wanting, brief satisfaction, boredom, and renewed wanting. His porcupine fable captures his view of relationships, creatures drawn together for warmth but separated by painful quills, forever seeking minimal suffering. Julius's therapy group serves as the novel's emotional center, where human connection unfolds in its complexity. Philip's entry, as part of Julius's supervision arrangement, introduces tension, especially with Pam, who returns from meditation retreat to find him in her former role as the group's intellectual. Each member battles personal struggles, Tony's womanizing and educational insecurities, Bonnie's inadequacy feelings, Stuart's ethical guilt, Rebecca's appearance fixation, and Gil's hidden alcoholism during marital breakdown. Julius's terminal diagnosis revelation transforms the group, as does Pam recognizing Philip as someone who had seduced both her and her friend, destroying their friendship. In a crucial session, members share their darkest secrets, Stuart's inappropriate patient relationship, and Rebecca's brief pregnancy-era prostitution. Their acceptance demonstrates vulnerability's healing power, though Philip remains emotionally distant. These sessions reflect our fundamental fears about being truly seen and the liberation that comes with genuine vulnerability. While most therapists view social avoidance as pathological, Schopenhauer celebrated misanthropy as virtue, believing strong individuals need nothing from others. Yet he pioneered concepts later central to psychoanalysis, the unconscious, repression, and self-deception. Despite his bleak worldview, Schopenhauer developed self-therapy strategies. His belief in his genius provided meaning, and he found companionship in his circle of close friends, the great thinkers of the world, particularly the Stoics. Philip's story shows how philosophy became therapy after conventional approaches failed. After 3 unsuccessful years with Julius, an inheritance allowed him to study philosophy, finding salvation in Schopenhauer's teachings. In a pivotal group session, Philip explains how Schopenhauer helped him overcome sexual compulsion by normalizing sexuality as the most fundamental force within us, while teaching that we're doomed to turn endlessly on the wheel of will, desiring, briefly enjoying, then falling into boredom. Philip's solution was leaping off the wheel through aesthetic contemplation rather than pursuing desires, enabling years of celibacy as escape. The group questions whether he has truly been in life without loving relationships. In a rare, vulnerable moment, Philip admits Julius's therapy had helped by highlighting the emptiness of his conquests and challenging him with a potential epitaph, "He fucked a lot," which motivated his change. As Julius's one good year wanes, he experiences time with unprecedented clarity, each moment taking on crystalline significance. He embraces Nietzsche's amor fati, loving his fate and living each day as if he would willingly repeat it eternally. The group's impending conclusion transforms everyone. Stuart confronts childhood poverty shame, Bonnie processes feelings about her ex-husband, Gil maintains sobriety despite marital difficulties, and Tony pursues academic dreams. Julius's cancer diagnosis reshapes his therapeutic approach. He becomes more transparent, sharing stories of failed marriages, professional doubts, and personal regrets. This role reversal activates healing within the group. In a defining moment, Julius shares, "There's only one way you can hurt me, and that is to cut yourself off from me." This declaration distills the existential insight gained through confronting mortality. Genuine connection serves as the ultimate buffer against death anxiety. Julius demonstrates how facing mortality teaches profound lessons about connection, vulnerability, and our enduring impact on others. 3 years after Julius's death, Pam, Philip, and Tony still meet weekly. Tony has earned his community college diploma. Philip returned to chess, and Pam speaks of her new relationship and Buddhist practice. That same day, Philip and Tony welcome 7 new members to their first therapy group. The participants sit in Julius's chairs, which Philip inherited and wept over, one of only 2 times he'd cried as an adult. Their approach combines Philip's philosophical knowledge with Tony's emotional accessibility. When tension arises between members, Tony channels Julius. "I've got a strong hunch that by the end of this group, each of you are going to prove very valuable to the other." Philip affirms, "Right you are, partner." Julius's legacy continues through his former patients, now healers themselves. While Schopenhauer's pessimism illuminates suffering, true healing comes from connection rather than detachment. As Julius discovered facing mortality, relationships, messy, painful, and glorious, give life its ultimate meaning. We heal not by escaping our humanity, but by embracing it fully, finding comfort in walking together through our shared experience.